application round. Except my absolute, although she's already started, you don't know who she is. Most people, I think, never know Dr. Stockley. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce you. Most people would know that she's been with the Center for Teaching and Learning as an associate director for years, and now she's the acting director of the Center for Teaching. Her area of expertise is adult learning in particular, as well as e-learning and educational development. I had the privilege to be in her class this summer where she taught, with very, very short notice, she taught transformative learning, and it's my delight that she's going to speak to us today about creating opportunities for transformative experience. As well as an expert educator, she's also a scholar. She has multiple research grants. With multiple faculties in this university. So it's my pleasure to introduce you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. And as you can see, as I was talking about earlier, I think our classroom environment is creating our transformative spaces. We're in the process of creating three completely team-based, problem-based, inquiry-based, whatever-based you want to call it, rooms, where the rooms are already configured to promote learning. And that's one of the goals, and we're working towards getting a new building that will do the exact same thing. The new medical building also has rooms that can do that, but it is a challenge for some people to get in there given the space constraints. So I always look at the room I've been given, curse a little in here, and think about how am I going to make it work for the kind of teaching I want to do. I left you on your own, but I'll tell you what I do with my lovely computing students. I actually have to physically, because they've never moved before in their entire life. I say, okay, I watch it for a few seconds. I say, well, a rectangle looks like this. Okay, this is a rectangle. Or if I do a pod, I say, well, a pod is this. Now, that's eight together. I want four. And how many? Let's divide it. So I actually have to explain it because they've never done it. And it's okay. I've ruined them now for the rest of their graduate education. And I'm okay with that. To create transformative learning opportunities, we have to think about how we're setting it up. Because I could have easily have left it that way. Leslie mentioned she took transformative learning with me, and as she knows, I didn't use PowerPoint at all. But Carolyn said she wanted to give the PowerPoint out after to other people. I thought, oh, I guess I should do it. So the idea, though, is that you teach to how the modality warrants. And I think it's really important to think about the rooms you're in. You may be in fixed chairs, which means, you know, things can't move no matter how much you want them to move. So I talk to my students about stretching. I really want to work your lower back muscles, and I want you to, let's see if you can turn a little. And I talk about those things and how important being physical in the classroom is. Even most of my courses are more cognitive rather than physical. I talk about that we need to develop those things. So I have a question for you, and I know some of you are what I would call plants, as in you know a lot about transformative learning. I know this. But I wanted you to just think about what transformative learning was for you, or your perception of it, and Leslie, and Sue, you know, you make sure you talk to people who don't know anything. But what is transformative learning, and what does it mean to you? And just spend a couple minutes. Have we even? Yeah, you and I'll be out live. So you just pair up and talk about what transformative learning means to you.
I don't know how far I'll get with my PowerPoint, but I'm going to send it to them. And it's like a party game after.
So you said the way you see and the way you think
about something. Your change.
Yeah. And you said you could communicate with that.
All right, just to give you another challenge, I want your small group to come up with one word to describe transformative learning.
And we're going to go around and say the one word, and then we'll listen to it. So one word to describe transformative learning. And it can't have transformative as a word or learning.
Oh,
okay.
We now have a great definition.
One word. All right. All right, so we're going to start over on this side. So we're going to start over here, and if I could have the first group. I can't whistle. If I could, I would. All right, one word. Shift.
Do you know what we thought?
Okay, that's the first.
Shift. I heard that as a response before.
Yeah.
I'm like quieter.
Yeah, I put her on the spot. Yeah, in fact, when I teach, I talk about inner and outer voice, you know? Inner voice can say whatever it wants. Outer voice is very, yeah. All right, shift.
Change.
Multi-directional.
Ooh.
One, two words.
Double barrel.
A dab, a hyphenated.
Perspective shift.
Okay, well, that's not really a hyphenated word. If I saw it in my students' work, I'd have an issue with a hyphenated, but I'll accept it right now. All right.
You're looking at me.
Well, I'm looking. Well, you're the only one facing me. They're all avoiding me. They're making it like television.
We're going to go with hope.
Hope. Well, nice. And
well, we have two.
Uh-huh.
Do you want us to pick one?
One.
In a minute.
Doesn't
matter. Well, light bulb.
Light bulb. Okay, that's one word too. Excellent. So transformative learning can be many things to different people, and it doesn't really matter what discipline you're in. It's really about what kinds of attitudes or abilities do you want. People teach transformative learning based on many perspectives, from cultural to social. I take it from a cognitive perspective. My background is cognitive psychology, or educational psychology, and so I always take it from what's happening here. And so my favorite word when I think of transformative learning is transfer. If they can transfer it to another situation and use it and have the ability to be changed by it, that's one thing. I'm going to be leaving Carolyn with the PowerPoint, so you don't... I mean, you're welcome to, because some people learn better writing, but you'll have this lovely PowerPoint that will look completely different on your screen. But the idea is that it's self-directed. And so the language I use is often metacognition or self-directed learning, self-regulated learning, but the idea is that it's about the person. I can't, and this is what kind of... I almost want to put a disclaimer on the introduction to this session. I can't make somebody have a transformative experience as the instructor. I create an environment where it could happen, but I actually can't change somebody. I could do it negatively, because as we know, transformative experiences can also be negative. So I could actually create a very negative environment. So those are easier to do than to create a positive transformative experience. So there's a... How many people are familiar with transformative learning? Before, a few of you? So this is the what I would call the introductory thing, where I condense everything in the field into 10 slides or less. So there's different theoretical camps or orientations, and it's important to know this, because if you decide after this session, or you've already decided, you're going to read everything you can get your hands on because you got excited. There's two different camps. If you read Mesereau and then you go right to, I always pronounce the name wrong, Brary, then they don't even talk to each other, but they use the same language, right? One says this is wrong and this is wrong. It's all good. But the idea is that with Mesereau and colleagues, they look at the individual and what's happening within. With the other group, they're looking at, well, actually, you know what? The individual operates within this huge community of practice and a huge... opportunity. Oh, come join us up here. We've got lots of them. So the idea is that it doesn't matter which camp you decide you're in, or you may say, actually, I think it's both, which is what some of my colleagues over here would say. And it's all good. It's just, again, recognizing that things happen and things change. So the big person that we talked about in this area is Mesereau. And Mesereau, the reason he's the big person is because he coined the phrase. He used it, typical of many educational researchers, actually not just education, but he created an environment where he tested the theory, made it work, but it was for females in continuing education. And he came up with these stages that they went through when they were transformed. Since then, like many educational theories, it's been adapted, modified, and moved on into other environments. One of the challenges that we talk about with Maslow's stages is the idea that it's not linear, or sorry, hierarchical. So if you don't do number six, you didn't have a transformative experience. In fact, depending on which work of Maslow's you read, he sometimes uses numbers, he sometimes uses bullets, he sometimes uses narratives. So the idea is that they're not meant to be this approach. And so recognizing that, you know, we have different stages, transformative learning can happen in different places. The idea of a disorienting dilemma is usually in all aspects of transformative learning. In my field, we call it cognitive dissonance, where something doesn't quite fit. You know, you have a way of being, and then something comes and you just have to figure out how it works. So the idea is that something happens that causes you to think or to shift. I've actually started liking my brain, and it's probably not a good analogy since Rolodexes aren't really sold anymore in the store. And some of you know what I mean when I say Rolodex, some of you may not. But I like myself to, when I was secretary in undergrad, this thing on the desk that just spins in this card. So for me, if I don't have a card for whatever it is, that situation, whether it's personal or professional, I have to create a new card. And I have that moment of what I call cognitive dissonance, because sometimes I don't have any blanks because I'm so tired. And then I have to think, well, what am I going to do? Where's a similar card to move forward? And so it's not a great analogy because it goes back to information processing theory, but with all, as Leslie alluded to, all the things on my plate, this is where my brain is at right now. How many people have worked with Maslow's theory? And what has it been like to work within the theory, and how have you adapted it? Or do you follow it?
I said it's early in the morning. I don't use it as a step-by-step kind of thing, and it was mostly when I was doing my research and work with stepmothers that I was using transformative learning theory to see if they considered that they had had a transformative experience. Mm-hmm. So it was very much focused in the individual camp and how did they see their experiences. So we talked a bit about these steps. I didn't, you know, lay it out here, the steps, where do you think you are, or anything like that, because it wasn't that type of research. But using that in terms of where they might be on their learning journey.
Other experiences? Anyone use it in their teaching?
So I'm sorry I'm late. I have a disorienting dilemma.
But you're here, so let's go.
So Lindsay and I are working on a project where we're looking at resident experience, so professional education, medical residents. And we based our interview questions using Maslow's theory, looking for examples of transformative learning. And I think the thing about what I find is that intuitively it makes a lot of sense to me that something happens during the resident's experience and that they change the way that they're going to do things. I find the theory a bit complex, and I find it hard to use it and to manipulate it because it's so detailed in its 10 steps. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I think we've been trying to, as I hear people talking, I think, okay, what would that represent in this theory? And it's really hard to fit it one-to-one, but I can definitely see what someone's describing being that step, and then, you know, maybe they'll jump to something else that represents another step. Mm-hmm. But it is a bit all over the map.
Absolutely. And other experiences that are different from those?
I would say that I have used it in a very general way, in the sense that we try to really get a perspective shift. Some of our OT students, like when they come in, they're operating in certain paradigms that we want to just kind of dispel and move them. So, you know, in terms of client-centeredness or medical model, like we don't operate from a medical model. And so we'll sort of throw something out initially to, like, ask them some questions so that they kind of, you know, and then... go through some cases and various things, and so we try to pull them along to the right thinking, and then sort of see where we are at the end. You know, you can have like concessions, but it's a very gross kind of application of philosophy.
And I think you've all, you know, those folks have said it, transformative learning isn't clean. It's very messy because I do a lot of research on with humans, and I always say the human factor gets in the way. You know, you have this nice, tidy study that on paper it looks so amazing, and then you get this human factor that just sort of transforms it in a way that's unintended. And it's actually really exciting because it actually evolves the research. But at the time when you're putting your ethics proposal and you're looking at all the little boxes, you have a very clean approach. And the human factor, I mean, if you ask somebody, and I did this with our course, I asked them to create a transformative learning experience for themselves. And I did it to highlight a point that it's not something you can necessarily intentionally do. And we had amazing things. Somebody, a couple of them went bungee jumping because they're afraid of heights. And some of them, I mean, I felt like saying, getting a disclaimer of what it was. Somebody learned archery. Somebody took a bus in Kingston for the first time, and it was quite traumatic. You know, there was such a wide range, because what's transformative for me may be not transformative for you. And so it makes it really hard as the instructor to say, I'm going to create these transformative experiences, because what I think is really will shift doesn't shift at all. And so part of it is really knowing who your students are, where they're coming from, and where do they need to go? So similar to what we talked about. There's research on conceptions of change, conceptions of teaching. So the idea is, how do you get them from here to where they need to be when they go into practice? And that's sometimes a really hard shift for some. Some people don't have that card. They can't get to that place. And it becomes quite a challenge as the instructor to think about, how will I help them get there? And sometimes we can't, because it's such a shift from where they are, that it becomes very difficult. So with Mesro, again, like I said, you know, he talks about four levels of transformative learning. So you have your existing frame of reference, so where you're starting from, and then you learn new frames, and sort of transform where you're going, and then it transforms a habit and mind. So the idea, this is actually easier to do from this, like from the 10 stages. It's hard to map out. This is actually easier. You can do pre-questionnaire. So what do you know? You know? And then you present them with new material or something different, a different way of doing things. Then they process it and say, yeah, you know what? This is actually a better way. This happens a lot in the clinical setting where the research happens, and then sometimes it takes a couple of years to catch up. But there is a better way to do something. And then when it catches up, it's like, yeah, you know, this is what we should be doing. And then it's transformed. And the person actually sometimes can't even remember that they ever did it the other way before. But the idea is that it does completely transform the process. If you think about, you know, an activity you learn that is just a habit of mind now, for example, many of you maybe drive or reading. You know, to learn how to read, I'll use reading, I know, obviously, to be here, you've all learned to read. But when you're in, you know, at home, or it was typically, you know, state the SK, but grade one is what was traditionally in Ontario, the age of about 6 years old, you learn to read. That's not a habit of mind. In fact, as a parent of twins, that's really painful to teach them how to read and how to get those things. But within a very short period of time, they don't know that they didn't know how to read. They assume that they've always done it. And this is for students who are more atypical learners, so without learning disabilities, but they see the world very differently when they don't read and then when they do read. And so if you think about your own practice or clinical setting or where you're supporting others, thinking about, well, how can we get it to the point? Because a lot of the health science fields, it has to become a habit of mind. You don't want somebody sitting in ER, or standing in ER, looking at thinking, okay, so where does this fit into my thing? It has to become more habitualized. Same thing when you have somebody coming in for OT or PT or RT, that same kind of thing. They come in with a problem, potentially, if they're coming into a clinical setting, and you're not going to read the textbook to find out where it is. It has to become a habit of mind. It's a different way of being. And I think in the clinical settings, it happens much more quickly because it has to happen more quickly. In my area, I can go read and have some casual time and figure things out and then come back. Here, it's not as possible. I should mention, I actually taught in this room. I taught a graduate course in OTPT and RT a few years ago, so it's kind of funky back. I learned a whole different way of being. I thought, I'll tell you about transformative experience for me. So I taught adult learning in the faculty of Ed. I taught it for years and years and years. And it was a particular year when they were closing doors, as in not as many people external could come in. So we had about three I assume everyone knows occupational therapy, physical therapy. So we had about three or four who wanted to come in, and they said no. They could only have two. And I said to my colleagues here, I said, if you can get me six, I'll teach it over here for you as part of my service. I ended up with 18 of them. So I thought, okay, this is great. It's the same course. I teach one Monday night. I teach one Wednesday night. Same material, right? Adult ed. Completely, my frame of reference was wrong. If I had known it, I wouldn't have done it in the same term 2 days apart because it was a completely different course. Same contract, like content or construct, but I had to teach it in a different way because how the students learned and their approach to learning was completely different than what I was used to teaching. And when I say that, it's about being more physical, more tactile. My examples didn't fit with their way of thinking, and I had to think about, and I'll be honest, I couldn't. And so I did exactly what I did here. I said, so, if we are talking about transformative learning, or with adult, how would it adapt to your situation? How does it adapt when you're in clinic? How does it adapt when you're in a home? And so they actually created the course. Because I gave them the constructs, and then I had them move forward, because there's no way that I could understand the kinds of things they were doing, because I wasn't trained in their area. And I respected that. And they got really excited, and the elaborations were absolutely amazing. But you have to, again, you know, for me, that was a huge shift because, you know, to me, adult ed is adult ed. You either are or you aren't. It takes me 36 hours to get to that point. So some essential elements to lead to change with deep structural shift. Dialogue is important. And depending on which literature you read, they'll tell you dialogue is internal. It could be external. It could be with the peer set. It could be lots of things. Critical reflection. Absolutely essential. One of the students in the transformative learning went to yoga, wasn't it? It was a meditative yoga, and she struggled because her inner noise was so loud that it was. Mm-hmm. She wasn't transformed by it, but she'll never do it again. So she knows. We've had some sort of conversation. So, but she thought that might be transformative because in the literature, people who are very committed to this form of yoga and going away for a retreat-type weekend come back in this euphoric state. Her euphoric state was, I'll never do it again. And so you can think that thing's transformative, but for other people it wasn't. And she said her hardest thing was sitting there in her head saying, this is good, this, you know, you get through it. Questioning beliefs and assumptions. This is actually a challenge for some people, particularly for different cultures. Different cultures do not question assumptions. They do not question beliefs. If it's presented as fact, they take it as fact. And so for transformative learning to happen, you have to start questioning those kinds of beliefs and activities. Are there any comments or questions about that? It's all second nature. Excellent. I'm going to make me work in a minute. So types of reflection. As I said, reflection is central. So if you encounter, and I always find it interesting because I think too much, I think. Students that don't think, like they can shut down and have their brain have no noise. I'm thinking, even having no noise is noise. I'm sorry, the static going on. But the idea is that you have to reflect. And some people like to have students journal. Some people have students do different kinds of things. But the idea is that reflection can be, it should be personal. And it should be related to a particular topic. The challenge with journaling in transformative learning as a class is that some people write to the instructor. So it's not a reflection. It's what do I think the instructor wants to hear, as opposed to a reflection of what they need to think about. And so as the instructor, you have to really let things go and say, here's the expectations. Some, Patricia Cranton, one of the proponents in this area, said, tell them they don't have to hand in their journals. And we were talking earlier before we started about accountability and bean counting. And it's like, so if they do the work and they don't hand it in, and somebody asks you how they got their grade, how does that work in our culture? Like at Queen's.
It doesn't, no. So you have to think about, well, what will I have them do that will highlight the transformative learning that has taken place? And there are different things. I've had students present. Some of them do choose to journal. Some of the students did scrapbooking, and it's kind of a fun activity in the sense that I'm not a scrapbooker at all. In fact, I'm just in awe when I see these beautiful products, thinking, where do they get the time? But they're lovely. And so some of the students did scrapbooks on transformative learning, and they, you can actually see in their scrapbooking that transformation occurred. And it was phenomenal. And so I always mention that as an activity to them, because there are some people that that's their glue that really gets them thinking. So I'm going to throw the question at you. Is why should you create opportunities for transformative learning? And are we still 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12? Yeah, so we're 15 of us, so maybe go in groups of 3 this time. And why should we create opportunities for transformative learning?
Well, actually, she doesn't have to because you're 15.
Oh, okay.
Are you here?
Oh,
yeah, I'm breaking you up, man. You're broken.
We're outliers.
So three.
I'm just going to listen.
So, no, I just didn't want to leave you alone.
No, she's with me, man. We are like, we're a team here.
Driving the bus.
We are
driving the bus. I'm being very nostalgic about the
that will be hard for us.
That's where I went.
It'll be fine.
So
that's where my head is.
They actually
are engaged in the right way.
And I think one of the reasons we need to create that opportunity is that the linear model that has functions doesn't leave that time for the creative action. So they have to be able to and then they're on to the next thing, and then they're back in your class next week. So if they really have to have a chance to think through a process or examine any of what they thought and feel or how what they said. And we have to create that thinking space and that dialogue space, whether it's individual journaling or whether it's 2 or 3 people talking something through. The traditional teaching model doesn't give you that examination space and that dialogue space and those sort of things, because it's on to the next thing and it's always on the test. Do I need this for the licensing exam? Like, it's not any course. It's, we need to create, and also we have to create the opportunities, because there are 2 on the treadmill to create them for themselves sometimes until they recognize the value of the knowledge. Until and unless. They might never recognize the value of someone that can create that space for them.
All right, we'll come back together in the group. And based on your conversations that you've had in your smaller group, I want you to write down individually and how you would apply it in your teaching environment, or if you're in a service unit, your service area. How would you apply what you just talked about to your own situation? I want you to write it down privately, just sort of as a promise to yourself, or if you're already doing it, there's a commitment that you're going to reaffirm you're going to do it. Now, how do you or could you apply transformative learning in your course?
or when you're working with others, because as I know there's a number of educational developers and researchers here, we provide opportunities for transformation to occur every day. So how would you do that in your consulting or working with faculty or grad students or whoever? Is anyone willing to share what they wrote?
For the role that I play, I've been doing a lot of ancient healing. Mm-hmm. And really what I needed to really focus on is my listening skills, questioning skills, and just general sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Because some of the issues that residents brought up was the first time they talked about them, and they were very emotional situations. So just finding the way to support them in that was, it's like the interview itself for some of them was sort of a transformative experience.
And that's what I was alluding to earlier with the, you know, when you complete the ethics form and they ask that question about adverse conditions or risks. And you say, no, I'm just asking him about X or Y, not realizing X or Y can actually trigger something. And then depending on how, you know, what your background is, you're sitting there thinking,
yikes.
And then what do you do next? Because it's not, wasn't planned. And so how do you deal with that? And when you're talking about transformative experiences, and you may not use the word transformative experience. You may talk about their past experience or, you know, something that cause to change or whatever words you want, but it can, even though you're thinking it's really positive potentially, it can actually trigger something very negative and it becomes a real challenge. And transformative learning, as I alluded to earlier, isn't always clean, and it's sometimes really messy, because sometimes how we transform is based on actually things that are very painful. And some of, you know, people talk about death, you know, I've had a loss and it's transforming in this way. Or, and they may not use the word transform, but they've completely changed their way of being. Or I was diagnosed with something, or I have a, you know, something physically, you know, is going to change in my life, or something, and that is a transformative experience that changes their way of being, and changes their way of being in research and teaching, or the learning experience. And you have to be aware of those things. Thank you for that. Any other experiences?
What I would say best to recognize that. Sorry, postpone kind of thing. Recognize that thinking time and time taken to talk things through, to examine ideas and assumptions, it's not extra and it's not nice to have. It's very valuable time spent, but sometimes because I come from a lot of background with deadlines, we're on to the next thing. And so we look at that as oh, that's kind of nice to have, but we don't have time for it. But it's actually essential if you're looking for that kind of transformative learning experience. If you're looking for people to examine the ideas that they have to have time to examine them. And then they have to have time to have dialogue, whether it's journaling, individual dialogue, or sitting with two or three people to talk things through. And I can think of a couple of committees that I worked on that I thought that they were taking an extraordinary amount of time to do something that was very simple, but it was actually the dialogue and the thinking time, and it changed some people's perspectives. So it's like, in retrospect, it was useful time, but at the time, at the moment, I just wanted them to get on with it, kind of thing. But sometimes people are transforming at very different paces, and so that time is necessary.
Absolutely, and as either consultant or instructor or research, whatever role you're playing, you have to think, what are you going to do while they're processing? Because in our head, we're thinking, it's taking forever. And you're looking at your watch.
The other thing is maybe I'm the one in the room that needs to be doing the transformation.
Exactly. So that's what I was
going
to say.
Maybe they're all fine.
You have to think about, well, what activity am I going to do here, or depending on the situation here, that's going to allow that time to happen. And this is where you get to know who you're working with, whether it's one-on-one or, you know, wherever you are, thinking about how much time, because we are experts in our field. That's why we are sitting here, and we're not the learner at this point. And I mean, when I mean learner, I mean, I know we all are learning, but I'm talking about we're passing knowledge on. And we have to recognize we didn't become experts by somebody just telling us something. We actually had to have that cognitive dissonance happen in some cases, or process, or just get masses of information that need to be retained up here. So how do we scaffold or build people to be that way? And so I have lots of different sort of like, mental models or different things I do, and that still looks like I'm engaged, but I've zoned out to give them that time. And so it's really important to think about how will you do that. When people go into groups, I can't, because of how we sit in the room, I couldn't do a walk around. But I walk around, and if they're in a group process, I see where they are. If they're starting to talk about something external, it's time to bring them back. Or recognize that that's part of the group process. And so you have to think about where things are. So I came up with a
few ideas on this from, you know, a wide variety of literature. But the first thing you should do is assess the needs. If you're meeting the person for the first time right now and you're only going to see them now, it makes it a little harder. But you can easily ask them, like I did here, who knows about transformative learning? What are your perspectives? Talk about it. You can do that. So assess the needs. When I'm teaching a course, or if I'm going to be working with somebody for a longer term, I do get a little intake questionnaire, just so I can find out something about the person and where they're coming from. People feel valued when you ask about their interests and experiences. Consider the affective sides of learning, so about, you know, the emotional side, that it's not just the cognitive. Determine goals and objectives for learning. Sue and I are working on quality assurance right now for the university. So this is a whole bunch of cognitive dissonant moments for a lot of departments right now. And I know in medicine and other areas of health science with the accreditation, you have to do those as well. Involve the learner in planning. Wherever possible, give your learners choices. It may be that the choices are contained, like as in, who do you want to work with right now? Or, you know, it could be something simple, or it could be, you know, create an assignment, pick one, that, you know, and apply your learning there. So it could be very low level to very high level, but get them involved. Create a delivery process at many points to active learn. If someone is just listening to you talk, they will not definitely have a transformative experience, unless you are one of those absolutely gifted people, orators, who just being in the same room with them transforms you. Jimmy Carter was at our convocation yesterday, and I talked to some people going out, and they were completely transformed. And I was like, really? Where was I? But this is the thing. I mean, people get transformed by different experiences. And there are people who can talk and cause a reaction because of something they said. It's, you know, they put up an image on their PowerPoint, or they say something. You get them hooked. Yeah.
But it sounds like, from your experience, that the person has to be receptive to that particular person as well.
They have to be receptive, but also even when you're not receptive, it still can cause a transformation. It's just whether or not they can sort of spin through that Rolodex and find the next thing. But there are times, in fact, a good friend of mine, John Freeman, in the faculty of Ed, when I came to Queens, I knew him long before Queens, he refused to use any technology at all. And he teaches 700 students. I mean, come on. So he was my challenge. And we had lots of conversations, and he was very adamant that he would never use technology or anything. And he uses not just power, he uses video, YouTube, all kinds of things now, because the environment is conducive for him showing and telling. Of course, he has lots of graduate student TAs who help him. I know some of you are in the room. But when we first start talking, there was absolutely no way. Now he couldn't go back. He could not use technology in his environment. Because when you're standing in front of your 700-plus students, you know, you need to have a way to engage with them. And if you're at the back, if you've ever been in the faculty event in the big balcony, and you're in the back row, it's really hard to engage. You have to find ways to get them involved. Providing ongoing and final evaluations of the learning environment by both the teacher and the learners. I always, when I teach, I make lots of notes. I have a either a lesson plan or notes or something, PowerPoint that directs me, and I've already, you know, making little side notes. And that's part of the reflection. It doesn't just happen after you leave a room. You think about, ooh, don't forget to do this, don't. And so you're constantly processing. If I was giving this again, I'd have my notes and say, oh, don't do that, or set up room beforehand, because it doesn't work. Some strategies, and I'm sure many of you have used these, but if you just look at the list, if there's any you're not sure about, you can just touch base on all those.
Circle of voices
around
them.
Sure. So what we did when we start, when I asked everybody or every group, I didn't have individuals, where you have everyone go around. Mm-hmm. When you're, particularly if you're with people for a longer period of time, you need to give them a voice very quickly. And the quickest way is to have everyone speak. And so coming up with something that's just asking a question and then having to respond to it. And finding those opportunities. And so I use those quite regularly when I want, you know, second or third class in, I notice that some of my students are very quiet again. And so I find another way of getting their voices in, because once they're heard, they're more likely to contribute again. And in a large lecture hall, you know, if you're teaching larger class settings, you can do that by having them pair up and talk to each other. So it doesn't all have to come to you, but the idea is that they're doing, you know, turning to their partner, finding a buddy. I was talking to a colleague who teaches first year physics, and he groups his students according to where they live, because that way he's starting to build community for them of cohorts. Mm-hmm. And so he knows that's one of his intake questions, where are you living, and he groups them. So it's not even about the content, but he wants to build capacity, and by doing that you build connections. Other strategies you're familiar with or less familiar with, I should say?
What's the start-stop?
That's my most absolute favorite thing in the whole wide world. This is where I ask the learners. I give them a piece of paper that literally looks for, you know, regular piece of paper. And then it just has lines, and it says start, stop, continue. And I ask the learners, what would you like me to start doing in class? What would you like me to stop doing in class? And what would you like me to continue to do? Very quick, I usually do about the third week in, get a pulse of the class so I can change things on the fly. But then I also ask them to do it for themselves. Now, as a learner in this environment, what are you going to start doing? And what are you going to stop doing? And what are you going to continue? I usually do it both ways, because I always tell the students, you know, if it's all about me, we're in the wrong place. Because you know what? You outnumber me. So you have to be a participant in the process. So I use it whether I'm doing faculty workshops or teaching a course or, you know, any point where I can make a change. Or it could be something like this, where I ask you at the end, now based on this experience, what are you going to start, stop? And I tell people it's a contract to themselves. And I tell them, you know, when you get back to your office, post it on your wall, right above your computer, so you have this contract of what you agree you're going to do. And so it works fairly well. And if I see people multiple times, I change the colors so that they should have a nice rainbow by the end. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Just want to mention something about journals. One of the things I did once with a colleague in a class is, it was one of the options for the exercises. We had a joint journal, mm-hmm. and so one of us would start and we would reflect on what happened in class, and then we'd hand it off. And then when you got handed off to you, you'd respond to what they had and also add your own. And so it was a very conversation journal. And we made a deliberate choice that we wouldn't do it online, we would do electronically, that we would have a physical journal and we would write and do that back and forth. And it slowed us down and made us really reflect and really thoughtful. And we'd been in a number of classes together, but having that time alone to reflect and write and then consider each other's thoughts was a very different experience than sitting talking about it. And that immediacy, we had that reflection time and then reflecting on each other. So it was an interesting thing to do, to have that shared journal and have that conversation in the journal while we were still taking some other classes together too. So, and as I said, we didn't do it online. We deliberately had it. We had to hand off the journal to each other.
I've never thought to do it with the learners, but when I get a journal, I actually write lots of comments, so it becomes a dialogue, and then by the end we have this whole, almost like writing letters back and forth. And then I had the students come together as a class to talk about the kinds of feedback and comments I get so they could learn. I like that one. We're on board with that.
That's from Patricia Grant.
And she didn't make us hand it in. She did not make us hand it in. We kept it was ours. She never saw it. Yeah. Did you go to Brock? Or you?
You and me.
I talked with her at Brock.
Yeah.
Love it. Side conversation. So what are the dimensions of learning? So when we think, and I don't know what it means by dimension. So I'll give you an example because it's the easiest one just so we'll sort of stop it. Cognitive. So when we're thinking about how people learn, we think of it from a cognitive perspective. What other things do we need to keep in mind when we're thinking about learning? For those who like competitions, there's five of them.
On your mark.
So we have to think about cognitive dimensions, right? We have to think about how people learn and how they process. And depending on your clientele, cognitive may be at very different ranges. My first teaching experience was in a class with children with autism. And so I was always aware of the different dimensions. They weren't always the ones targeted. So what else is there besides cognitive?
Affective,
so emotion.
Yeah.
Is psychomotor?
Physical, yeah, absolutely. So those are the three most common ones, because if you look at Bloom's or others, they always have affective, psychomotor, and cognitive. Like those are the three. What are a couple other things that we need to think about when we're talking about transformative learning? Well, so you should remember this from class. I was going to say
sensory.
Sensory? Yeah. I could buy sensory.
Motivation.
Okay.
Culture.
Sort of ethical, moral.
So looking at it from the sort of balancing of skills. I don't start early.
Social.
Spiritual. And the thing is, typically when we plan our lessons or we plan working with somebody, we're typically targeting just the cognitive, right? We're talking about, content and different things like that. But we have to think about, well, where are they coming from? You know, some people learn very well in a community-based approach, and some practices that you're in has to be community-based. I mean, it's not very often you can decide you're going to work by yourself. I know some days you wish you could. It's not the reality of our world. And so you have to think about, well, how in our classroom are we creating that environment for people to learn how to be social beings? And you think, well, they should have learned that in kindergarten. Well, the reality is kindergarten is very different from undergraduate, graduate, residency practices, clinical practices, because it's a different way of being social. You know, nobody wants to know necessarily every detail what you did Friday night, but you want to be able to have a collegial working relationship. And so how do you build in social? How do you build in those kinds of things? Spiritual is also left out. People tend to think of spiritual as a religion, and it's not about religion. It's about looking at the essence and figuring out what does that mean. And if we neglect that, we also neglect a part of the overall process. So those I find it challenging when I'm teaching to think about how am I going to target each of these different things. And sometimes I get it right. Sometimes I get completely wrong. Because of, again, that human factor gets in the way sometimes. I think it's going to work, and it goes completely away. But the idea is that when you look at a person, they're a whole person, and these are the different things that they are combating and doing different things with. So the other, you mentioned, culture, and that's the other... Going back to Freire and others' work, we can't separate that individual from all these different things that are happening. Reading about something and living it are two different things, and that's context. The climate is huge, and the culture is huge. I mean, if you've been at the university long enough, I mean, this is, I keep using the thing of the British terms, the austerity measures. It has completely changed how we do education between the accountability, the financial crisis, so many different things, the number of students who end up in the classrooms. It has completely changed our environment, and that's our context.
Other universities have approached things differently. Not saying they're better or worse, but their context and their culture is very different from ours. The climate here at Queen's after the CUFA, you know, with 11th hour, for those of you in there, where, you know, at 5 a.m. we got the notice we weren't on strike at 6:30 or 7. You know, that changed. In fact, we're just coming out of that. And I'm saying from a Center for Teaching and Learning perspective, we could actually see, you know, the morale way down here. And it's just starting to pull back up again. And it's taken a year. I have colleagues who teach at York, and they're on strike for one reason or another fairly regularly. And they're in a constant state of flux in that institution. Because, you get your ground and then something happens. And climate and culture are so different. And thinking about, well, how will I react to those things? How do I create a really positive experience where transformation can take place in light of all these things happening in the background? I call it talking about the noise. This is the noise. But this noise is so loud because it's their reality. And you don't know the reality, and you don't need to know the reality. You know, we have a number of students who have, you may have interviewed them or had in your classes, who come from very tragic situations. We have a number of refugee students. We have a number of, I was talking to a colleague whose research is in a childhood pedophile rape and things like that. And her students the students who take the course will never be the same because they've learned something that completely is disruptive to their way of being. And she actually has to put a warning on her course. And people, of course, ignore her warning. And can recreate tragic situations. And the reason I bring that up is her intention is to transform, but not everybody is ready for transformation in a particular area. And so the idea is, how do we create those environments? And disclosure is one of them. I actually put on every syllabi when I'm teaching that you will participate in this way, as in we are going to, I expect everyone to talk, I expect everyone to engage. If you don't want to do this, this probably isn't the course you want to be in, because there's really nowhere to hide in my classes. Really. I mentioned when we set up the environment here, is that I set it up so there is nowhere to hide. Every class, I change it based on what I'm trying to do. So I sometimes have groups of four, because I don't want everyone to talk every class, because, let's face it, you never get through anything. And of course, some of you are thinking, that's not the point. The idea, though, is that you want to create environments where people have the space to talk. And thinking about, again, going back to the physical side, physical isn't always tactile. It could be just the room. And thinking about, how am I going to do that? I really think that if we neglect, as I had that first chart, those five things, we have a disservice to our students. So sometimes some of the classrooms here are deadly. The seats are deadly. You sit in them, and you just think, I'm sitting on something that I wouldn't, I'm thinking about, Dunning and some of the lecture theaters. You can't change that. But you can talk about it and how that affects learning. You can create environments where some people love to have people stand up and stretch. Of course, I always hate doing that. My background, I just hate doing anything like that. But I always feel better afterwards. Then I got to try it in my classroom. I haven't quite got there yet. But thinking about ways that you can make your environment work for you is really essential. And recognizing that there is a lot of things happening in the background. And how can you adapt it into your environment? When I teach adult ed in the evenings, or whenever I've taught in the evenings, I always spend the first 10 minutes as an icebreaker. Every single class. Not a, hi, my name's Denise. A content-based icebreaker, where they're focusing on the content, but I know that they've come, especially if they have a day job, if they have children, if they have anything happening here, when they get to me, they're not with me yet. And I need to transition them to start being open to possibilities. And so I found when I start teaching right away, I've lost that opportunity because they're not here yet. And so it's not putting in fillers, it's actually content-based icebreakers that's bang on in what we're doing. When I talk about intercultural teaching, I put up a map. In fact, I saw in the room next door they have maps of the world. I put a map of the world and I said, where have you learned and where have you taught? And we got two different color stickers. And that just transitioned them into the particular topic of the day. Again, gets them moving, gets them focused, shifts the gear. Same thing happens if you have the lovely privilege of a Friday morning, 8:30 a.m. class with undergraduates. Thursday night is still their night to go out. Mm-hmm. They're not quite there yet, so you don't put the most important thing right at the first 2 minutes of class. You might want to ease into it a little bit later. Is there any other comments or questions or ideas that we haven't touched on? Because I recognize we're out of time.
I have a question.
Sure.
What do you do in a group setting when we're working towards this transformation? Mm-hmm. You said you're entertaining yourself by different activities. Mm-hmm. What is it that you do? Because it is a little bit tempting to try and talk people along.
So I actually focus on something that I have to do for work. So I do, like, I work through a problem in my head. So if it's a research problem, I start thinking, okay, so how am I going to deal with that? So I actually, whatever's like on my next to-do list, I start mentally preparing myself for that.
So can you do that and engage in the conversation as needed?
I do, because what I do is, as I said, I couldn't walk around here, but I, every so often, depending on how long they have, I get up and walk around.
Oh, I assume that you're in a meeting with people.
If I'm in a meeting with people, I wouldn't go into a research problem because they'd have a hard time getting me out of it. No, so I just sit there and wait. And I just, sometimes I do those Jeopardy songs in my head or whatever. There's no magic bullet. It's just, whatever will get you to the point where you can give them the space and recognizing that you do have to prompt. I mean, it's very different from a counseling background, like where it's a different kind of prompting. And a different kind of setting, but at the end of the day, you do have to allow thinking time. So if you ask a question and then you answer it for them, whether it's in a one-on-one or a group setting, it's your answer, it's not theirs. Right, so you have to really think about how you want to do that. It's not easy. I do process the rest of my day, because then it means when I get to the next meeting, I'm already prepared. And sometimes if that is with an individual, I focus on what their needs are and think about, okay, I'm listening to what they're saying. And sometimes it's dead silence, so there's nothing to hear. But I know what they came for, and so I'm thinking, okay, so if they say this, sort of going through all the mental models, okay, if they say this, this is where we're going. If we go here, 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 here. So depending on the situation, it's focused completely on them, or whether or not it's, completely irrelevant, I go into my own space. And I get my reflection time, which I don't normally get during the day ever. Well, thank you.
With that, I'd like to ask everyone to join me in thanking Denise Stockley. Thank you so much for this. This is just the opening of a door. Let's think about starting, stopping, and continuing. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And of course, we have to put the desk back because we'll get in trouble by the next class.
And please fill out your evaluations and leave them with Carol and thank you.
If you haven't filled out the time sheet or the attendance sheet as well.